Thank you for joining us for our fourth quarter market update call. Joining us on the call today is Craig Bolanos, founder and CEO of Wealth Management Group. Craig, the call is yours.
Thank you, Lisa. You know, the impact of COVID-19 on the U.S. economy has created unprecedented levels of uncertainty for investors. You know, with a heated election, that almost becomes the cherry on top for 2020. We've had a lot to digest since the market's bottoms back in March of this year. You know, the virus is not yet under control, and while the U.S. economy showed signs of improvement, there's still some areas of concern that obviously remain to many. And we know now that certain industries might be years away from fully recovering, while others are progressing at what I call a reasonable pace and cadence. And the contrasts in Washington, D.C. are ever-present, and with the presidential election now less than 2 weeks away, we thought it'd be a great opportunity to connect with everyone to provide a high-level up-to-date as to where things stand. We're pleased to be joined today by Susan Olson. Susan Olson is Vice President, Government Relations at Natixis Investment Managers, located right in the heart of Washington, D.C. She serves as the point person for the firm and helps to maintain awareness of the regulatory environment as well as the legislative issues and initiatives. We're also happy to have Jack Janisiewicz back by popular demand with us today. Jack is a Senior Vice President and Portfolio Strategist and Portfolio Manager of Natixis Investments, located in Boston. Let's jump right in. Susan, we're now 11, 12 days away from the election. We have record early voting, an electorate that seems more engaged compared to what I can remember in recent memory. Where do you think sit today as we sprint towards November 3rd?
Thank you so much, David. It's a pleasure to be here. So yes, we are. It's definitely crunch time, and the votes are really starting to roll in. So as far as voter enthusiasm, we're seeing polling numbers that show record numbers of people who are enthusiastic to get out the vote. According to a Mama's study, it's 96% of Americans are very or somewhat eager to vote. And the undecideds are much lower than what we have seen in the past as well. So whereas in 2016, approximately 15% of Americans were undecided literally as they walked up to their voting booth on who they were going to vote for. This year, it's much lower, with the number probably closer to around 5%. So people really have made up their minds on who they are going to vote for. And as I mentioned a minute ago, very enthusiastic to cast their vote. So we do expect that with the mail-in ballot, even during an early voting, even in the midst of a COVID crisis, that we will see people turn up and turn out. So we're excited for this campaign, or for this election season, to manifest itself and see who the winner is.
No, absolutely. Enthusiasm runs rampant. So, Susan, so many people were caught completely off guard because the polls in 2016 they couldn't be anything other than wrong. So one of the questions I have is, you know, for everyone who's on Main Street, you know, can we actually trust the polls as a good barometer of how people are actually going to behave? Or maybe better yet, what indicators and things do insiders like yourself in D.C. actually pay attention to?
That if I had to rank all the questions this year, that would definitely be number one. Yes, Dave, the polls did seem to walk away with a big black eye in 2016, and that they just really blew it with the majority of all the polls, large, medium, and small, calling for a Hillary Clinton win. But really, if you dig a little deeper, they actually didn't get it as wrong as you think. Believe it or not, the pollsters correctly called the winner of the 2016 election in 47 states. It really came down to just three states that they got it wrong, and that was Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. But how wrong did they get it? Not by much. In Michigan, they were only, quote-unquote, wrong by 0.2%. And in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, they were only wrong by 0.7%. Of the 14 million votes that were cast between those three states, the candidate Trump won by just over 77,000 votes. So it was razor thin. However, because of the vast number of polls that did call for Hillary Clinton to win, it seemed like they really got it out of whack. But they were actually closer than you think. However, that doesn't let them off the hook. They still had to go back and say, okay, we got it wrong. How did we get it wrong? And it really comes down to demographics. In 2016, candidate Trump was polling very well with white men and women without a four-year college degree, concentrated in industrial and manufacturing areas around the country. Well, what the pollsters didn't bother to do was expand their polling base to make sure that this demographic was adequately represented in their polls. That was mistake number one, which obviously led to mistake number two, is since they didn't bother to do that, they certainly didn't bother to see, okay, where do these people live? Where does this demographic reside with in the United States? And if you did a heat map, obviously you would see a lot of this demographic reside in what we call the Rust Belt, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, areas that have historically been their huge hubs for our manufacturing and industrial sectors in the United States. So that's where they got it wrong. So this time around, they are trying to be much more diverse in their polling base and make sure they grab from all different demographics, ages, and races. So this year, though, we are already thinking, okay, what could be the holy cow issue of this year? Well, again, going back to 2016, one other thing that the polls didn't grab was the kind of, we call it the shy pollster, if you will, the person who did not want to necessarily admit that they were voting for candidate Trump. Probably especially if you were a woman after the Billy Bush incident earlier in October, but they still voted for, you know, they still disliked Hillary Clinton enough to cast their vote for Donald Trump and take the chance on him. This year, we don't think we'll have that percentage of the shy voter, and if we did, it might not just be a Donald Trump shy voter. I mean, think about it. President Trump's supporters are passionate. They will walk on glass to vote for Trump. They will walk on glass to go to a rally. So if you are an outlier in that group and you're like, I kind of think I might want to vote for Biden, you're not admitting to that to your buddies at the ball field. So it actually might work the other way around. But we do think that there could be a holy cow issue or a place for Donald Trump, and that is with the rural voter. So we hear a lot about how voter registrations are at all-time highs. You know, we hear it on the news, we read it, and really when I see it on the news, it's focused around metropolitan areas, which would lead one to believe that, okay, this must be just a Democratic thing. The Democrats are getting people to register. Not so much. It is also the rural area, and that's really where Donald Trump has been trying to focus to expand his current base, is to reach out to that rural voter who rarely votes or who never votes and get them to the polls. And finally, the other thing that was going to come to the advantage that we assume is more of a Democratic thing is the mail-in ballot. I'm from rural Nebraska. You know, I know that if, you know, my family members on the farm, if it's cold or they have, you know, farm stuff to do that day, they're not going into town to go to the polls. Well, this time they have the mail-in ballot too. So again, that could work in that favor as well. So we still look at the look to the polls. It's the only way we can show, see momentum and where the country at large is thinking.
No, I appreciate that. That's incredibly insightful, especially your opportunities for what I call the holy cow moments. So if we bring it into today, what's in the news? I've talked on TV about this recently again. Susan, the stimulus packages that were passed earlier this year, I consider them to be nothing short of revolutionary, to be quite sincere. I mean, they were the key ingredient, you know, to helping the market and the economy recover. Now, we know that both sides of the aisle want to pass a second round of stimulus, and there's been some agreement on core components, you know, airlines, paycheck protection program, stimulus checks. However, it can't seem to get across the goal line. So, Susan, with your contacts in D.C., break it down for us. What's facts? What's fiction? Where's the holdup right now on stimulus?
So there has been a big, gigantic gap between the Democratic proposal and the Republican proposal. The original Democrats proposal was $3.4 trillion. They have scaled that back down to $2.4 trillion, and the Republican proposal is $1.1 trillion. And the reality is that you have a decent number of Republican senators who A, don't want to vote for a package whatsoever. They do not want to put one more dollar on the deficit. And B, you have about 10 of those, and then you have about another dozen Republican senators who are. It's going to be very hard to get them over that $1.1 trillion mark. So, you know, we've seen these months and months of negotiations, but recently, you know, you've mainly been hearing about how House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, who negotiates for the president with congressional leadership, how those two have been meeting. Well, this is a three-legged stool, and we're missing one of the legs, and that's the Senate Republicans. Mitch McConnell, the number House Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, number two Republican John Thune, number three Republican John Cornyn, they have not been involved in this at all. They have not been eager to bring over a bill, especially in the range on which Mnuchin and Pelosi are negotiating, which is somewhere around the $1.82 trillion mark. The other reality is that, you know, Mitch McConnell is just not going to bring a bill to the floor this close to the election when he doesn't have all of his Republican support. Because if we just did the numbers real quick, Mitch McConnell could get a House passed bill if they were to pass, if Mnuchin and Pelosi were to agree on something, he could get it passed because he'd have Democratic support. However, with just 31 Senate Republicans left who would be willing to look at a Democratic bill for stimulus, you'd still have 47 Democrats who would vote for the bill. So what do the optics look like on that? The optics are that Leader McConnell brought a Democratic-sponsored bill to the floor on the eve of the election. So frankly, and I can go on with Nancy Pelosi, you know, with the House as well. They have been stubbornly negotiating, you know, sticking with their numbers, knowing that the Republicans probably aren't going to go for it. But she keeps getting pressured and pressured. She was getting pressured that she was playing politics and didn't want to give the president a win or the House Republicans a win. And frankly, part of that is true. But her moderate Democrats have been pressuring her to at least do something because, you know, the House members are up for re-election every 2 years. They're campaigning as we speak, and they needed something to go back to their districts with the stimulus fight. So that's kind of the reality. It's just they have been playing politics with it, but it's going to get serious real fast when we start seeing weakened labor numbers, economic numbers, and the slow economic recovery that we have been watching slows down.
No, absolutely, and Jack and I will be talking about that component in a minute. So the bottom line is, it is trench warfare, and both sides aren't willing to compromise on certain issues this tight to the election. Both are hiding for cover, so I can understand that. So listen, Susan, another thing that's key to this election I think people want to know about, there appears to be a very wide disparity in both corporate and personal tax rates, you know, relative to the platforms of both candidates. Can you kind of break that down for us and explain your understanding of the two varied and different proposals, you know, the different tax structures for those that are listening?
Sure, but it's between Trump and Biden or Biden's two-pronged tax approach?
Really just between Trump and Biden. We'll keep it on that level today.
Okay, well, with the president, we don't expect anything to change. Well, you know, he passed the Tax Cut and Jobs Act in 2017. So we do think that that the tax rates for both corporate and individuals will remain at that level. I know he has talked about some additional tax cuts, but nothing in writing, nothing that we can, like, start looking and analyzing on. But with Joe Biden, he has put out his plan for raising taxes, and it's really a two-pronged approach. He's looking at raising taxes on corporations and on the people making over $400,000. So with corporations,
Susan, break that down. Talk about the corporate change, and then also focus on these various impacts to the individual side for all of our listeners.
You got it. So with corporates, he's looking to take the tax rate from 21% to 28%, which is a significant hike. It's a third higher. but it's still lower than where the tax rate was prior to the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, which was a global high of 35%. He's also looking to put a floor of 15% tax on all corporations making more than $100 million a year in book income. The reason he's proposing this is because there are so many of our country's largest and most profitable companies who find ways to not pay any taxes after they find their loopholes and write-offs. So he wants to put an end to that and make them at least pay their fair share. And then also he's looking to double the foreign tax rate on U.S.-based companies with foreign subsidiaries. You also see companies, our large companies like tech companies, healthcare companies, you know, with things like patents, who will sell a patent to their foreign subsidiary, so all the profits from that patent runs through the foreign subsidiary at that country's rate, which obviously if they're going there, it's a lower rate. But when they bring it back, right now that's taxed at 10.5%. He wants to double that to 21%. As far as individuals, there has been a lot of kind of confusing information out there when you look at the ads, you know, coming from the Republicans, or, you know, you read about their opinion of Biden's tax plan. And that is that they're saying, you know, that it will affect, I think the number is 82% of Americans. I work on tax in D.C., so we have to go based on what he has actually written, what is written and what is proposed. And he really is proposing a to raise taxes on just people making more than $400,000 a year. And, you know, he's approaching that from a moral and a fiscal standpoint. But for the moral side, the reason that they're proposing it on that income is that they want to address income inequality. So that would be antithetical to their goal if they were to raise taxes on the lower and middle class. So they really are trying to avoid raising tax on them. So, but what are they proposing for the $400,000 and above? Well, they are proposing to raise the individual rate back up to 39.6% from the 37% where it was lowered after the Tax Cut and Jobs Act. They're looking to also assess the FICA tax back on people who make over $400,000 a year. Now, the FICA is the payroll tax that we use to fund Social Security. Currently, that is a 12.4% tax that is split between the employer and the employee. That tax is assessed up to your income of $137,700. Once you go over that, you and your employer no longer pay that FICA tax. The Biden proposal says that once you start making more than $400,000, that FICA tax kicks back in. Now, that's not to say they're going to claw back that 12.4% from the income you made between 137 and 400. That will remain exempt. But once you go over that 400,000, it'll kick back in. They're also talking about taxing capital gains and dividends at ordinary income tax rates for people making more than $1 million a year. So right now, capital gains and dividends are taxed at either 15 or 20%. So this would essentially double their tax rate since it will now be at 39.6. Now, just as a side note, with the exception of kind of one-time hits for people who maybe inherit an estate, sell a property, sell a business, the people who consistently make over $1 million a year in our country, the number is about 500,000. And then finally, they're looking to possibly eliminate a step-up basis for inherited assets with capital gains. What this is, it's a tax accounting procedure that if you buy a stock at $10 and you will that to your heirs, not your spouse, but your heirs, and at your date of death, that stock is worth $100, your heirs inherit your date of death cost basis, not the date of purchase. So they are proposing that. And again, another side note, this is an issue. We call it a whack-a-mole issue here in D.C. This comes up all the time. So far, we've been successful lobbying against this. And I don't know that necessarily in a final proposal that this would make it, but this is something that is coming, that comes up every time taxes come up.
But Susan, I'm happy you bring up that last point, because while your first several talking strategies affect high income earners, the last one, the elimination of a step up in bases, that theoretically affects everybody up and down the income ladder. I thank you for your insight and your comments. Jack, let's take some of Susan's thoughts that she shared and turn them into what I call some sincere and actionable ideas on the economy and the market. And, you know, I get started as we banter back and forth. If there's one takeaway from 2020, it's that the economic and market recovery appear to many to be somewhat uneven. I mean, on one hand, you know, I hear about new and existing home sales both hitting 14-year highs. I see manufacturing having increased for the last several consecutive months. You know, and all of that on the surface, you know, would suggest to someone that the recession, you know, is at the tail end, if not over, even though things don't feel right where a lot of us live on 123 Main Street. I mean, there was a headline the other day that Amazon announced, hey, it's going to hire 33,000 new employees at six-figure wage bases, while on the other hand, I saw a counter headline from, you know, Dave and Buster's Live Nation reporting their last quarter's revenue was down some 85% to 98% respectively because consumers are staying home. So can you help put in perspective for us this divergence we're seeing to any of the casual observers, because we're consistently getting mixed signals between what appears to be the market and the economy?
Yeah, and I think that's a pretty important point. And if you hear a lot of the commentary of late, a lot of people are describing that sort of phenomenon as the K-shaped recovery, right? You've got sort of the initial leg down, and then we start that V-shaped recovery, and then you're sort of getting a branch coming off of that that movement to the upside, so to speak, creating those two legs off of the K. And what does that mean? Well, that's sort of what I would call the haves and the have-nots, but even more so, probably more appropriate, it's probably the winners and losers. And it's pretty straightforward, right? When we think about what the response was to a healthcare crisis, the government response was effectively create a recession. And what happened on the back of that, anything that was involved with really the services sector side of the equation was adversely impacted. And that it makes sense, right? If we were basically stuck at home, a lot of those services industries require you to get out and really get out in visiting a lot of these places to spend money. So think about it. You know, on the entertainment side, you have to really get out and go to the movie theater, go out to a football game. The airlines and the cruise lines, you have to get out and physically get on board a plane and get on board a boat. Restaurants and bars, all of those things, services related, which require you to get out and about, that's where you're really seeing a lot of those headlines that you referred to get adversely impacted. So the response from the government to address the healthcare crisis was basically to really hurt some of those industries. The flip side, though, what's doing well is still the manufacturing side of the equation. And why is that? Well, think about it. We can still shop. We can still order online. We're still doing some of our day-to-day activities from a necessity standpoint. And as a result, the manufacturing side of the equation has actually held up quite well. And I think a lot of that points back to the idea that, again, remember, consumption is about 70% of the U.S. growth backdrop. And a lot of what drove that growth backdrop is coming from that fiscal package. And I know Susan was alluding to some of the details on that, but as a lot of the people on the service sector side were basically let go, furloughed, or you know, any sort of combination of those, the social safety nets that were put in place, the unemployment benefits, you know, the $1,200 a week check that was sent out, the $600 a week kicker for unemployment benefits, that put money in everybody's pockets, so that allowed them to still be able to spend. And so that, I think, is really at the heart of what we're seeing here, the ability for the consumption side of the equation to still hold up because of the safety nets the government put into place. And who is benefiting from that? Well, you're still able to spend. And the bigger ones there are going to be on the good side. The services side obviously reacts a little bit differently because you need to physically get out and attend those areas, and that's where we're seeing that headwind, and that's what's creating this sort of bifurcated recovery, so to speak.
No, so then that makes sense. So the bottom line is the hypothesis that fiscal stimulus drives additional consumption, which in turn supports asset prices, is very much in play, and a second round of stimulus would probably be nothing more than accretive. So the bottom line is, if we turn this into just the question of the day, the soup du jour, because I want to be direct in answering it, you know, does the economic data warrant the stock market rally? And is this going to go down literally as the shortest recession in the history of the United States?
And so that right there is the number one conundrum that I think that I received from a lot of our investors over the course of the year. They didn't understand, given the backdrop, the headlines, the things you referenced relative to what the stock market was doing, they didn't understand how this could be happening. And it goes really back to the idea that the stock market and the economy are somewhat two different things. Although interrelated longer term, the short term things are very different. And what do I mean by that? Well, I think the first one to think about, when you start to look at services as it relates to the overall economy, the U.S. is largely a service-based economy. So when you start to see these shutdowns in the unemployment data, that certainly doesn't give us warm, fuzzy feelings on the economic front. But when we shift it over to the profit cycle, so to speak, the earnings side of the equation, the S&P 500 is much more manufacturing-driven. Almost two-thirds of the earnings per share backdrop in the S&P 500 is manufacturing-driven. And so when you sort of think about what we were just talking about, the consumption side of the equation, consumption actually held up very well. That bodes well for the manufacturing side of the equation, and manufacturing is almost two-thirds of the earnings per share backdrop for the S&P 500. So that's sort of how we can understand the dislocation between maybe what we're seeing with regard to the unemployment data, and yet the backdrop for the S&P 500 still remains quite positive. And I'll say this one other way, it's the same idea. Those adversely impacted sectors of the market, when you look at the total composite operating earnings, so think about the parts of the world that were the economy that were really adversely impacted, i.e. the services sector, so think retail, restaurants, bars, entertainments, hotel, tourism, that sort of thing. That's only about 7% of operating earnings for the S&P 500. So, sure, we're seeing some bad numbers on the unemployment front, but those sectors adversely impacted don't have a significant portion of contribution to the overall earnings backdrop. It really is the manufacturing side that is the big driver for earnings in the S&P. That's been holding up because of that social safety net, because of that spending. That's the big difference between what we're seeing with regard to the economy in Wall Street.
No, and I'm happy you made that last point, because even with dire news, you can always take dire news and turn it into opportunity under the guise of controlling what you can control. And that's why throughout the year we've been working on what I call the tax harvesting of equities, various bond swaps up and down the yield curve, because it has been slightly uneven. But, you know, Jack, one of the things I get with some degree of frequency when people call into a radio program, other things, just discussion with clients, is, you know, together we all know history is a divine teacher. It's our experience that shapes us. And asset allocation, time over time, tends to win. But over the short term, we see these very wide discrepancies in performance. And a lot of people are becoming aware of this discussion now of how stock indices are created. What I mean, equal weight versus cap weighted. Can you explain the difference between equal weighted and cap weighted? And also, what's that implication for investors, and what should their takeaway be?
So when we think about the concept of equal weighted, and let's talk about the S&P 500, and I actually believe there's a little more than 500 companies right now in the S&P 500, so a little bit of a misnomer, maybe a 506. But the point here on the equally weighted side, every one of those 500 companies within an equally weighted constructed index gets the same weight. So if we just simply say there's 500 companies in there, we take 1 divided by 500, each company gets basically 20 basis points worth of an allocation in that portfolio. Stays constant. You don't have huge run-ups on either side because everything continues to rebalance. The issue on the market cap weighted side, think of this more as a momentum play, right? The size of the market cap, so it's the value of that company as defined by the share price and the shares that are outstanding within the index. So just multiply the two. That gets you a total market value. Those market values of all those 500 companies are then aggregated, and then your weighted average based into that on those data points. So what does that mean? As you consistently get appreciation in single names, they become a greater weight in the portfolio simply based on the math. So what does that do? It basically gives you a momentum-driven index. The winners continue to become bigger portions of that indice, and as a result, that momentum factor is already sort of embedded in those portfolios. So to give you a specific example, right, if we look at the S&P 500 today, Apple accounts for almost 6.5% of the S&P 500. think of it again. It's market cap weighted. Apple stock has done very well. It's going to continue to get a bigger share of the S&P 500 because it's outperformed everybody else. Where does it sit within an equally weighted index? Well, it's still going to get that 20 basis points worth of exposure. So very different in terms of how these portfolios could be set up when you look market cap versus equally weighted. But when you take a step back and look at the big picture thing, right now, what's been the winner? Technology. Technology then has a significant bigger overweight in the market cap weighted index relative to equally weighted. So bringing this all together, if we were to look at the differences, tech is a very big player in the market cap weighted ones. Cyclicals, probably a little bit bigger weightings within the equally weighted ones, and it's simply a function of who's done better more recently. Cyclicals have underperformed, hence they don't have quite as big of a weight in the market cap ones, whereas tech's done so well. Then as a result, tech is a significant weight in the market cap indices. So better diversification when you start talking about market cap versus equally weighted.
That makes some sense to me. So listen, Jack, you're responsible for managing money. Susan has her insight into D.C. These election times generally see these increases, sometimes, in overall market volatility. Can you share with us some of the thought leadership pieces that your firm is focusing on relative to investment opportunities in the current climate?
Yeah, and this is also, I think, something that's very important. And you know, you heard Susan go through a bunch of things with regard to her thoughts on sort of how the outcomes can play. The issue here, though, is simply it's very difficult, I think, to really make a forecast, and then more importantly, actually put some sort of investment thesis behind the potential outcomes. So that makes it very difficult. And I think it goes back to what you were originally saying. You know, we want to fall back on the basics with investing, and that simply comes back to the idea that stick with the process that's in place. Stick with the idea of diversification. I know it's very easy for investors to sort of fall in love with some of these hot topics, a lot of the performance chasing. That can go so far, but at some point, those are going to tend to be mean reverting, and you're going to have some sharp profit taking on the back of that. So when we go into these uncertain times, it really matters most focusing on diversification, making sure we have those equity risk offsets in the portfolio, which that's fixed income we're talking about. I know treasuries more recently have gotten a bad rap because of where they sit in terms of the yields, but they still provide that equity risk offset. When equities go down, bonds go up. That's what you need in the portfolio. It also acts as a place, so when the market does sell off, you can take advantage of that by selling some of your bonds and buying equities. The point being here, again, stick with it. Stick with the traditional portfolio. Stick with your process. Stick with diversification. Don't lose sight of that. And we're going to have our bumps along the way, but the point being the longer-term economic cycle is what matters here, and we are certainly recovering off of some significant low levels. The economic backdrop, slow, uneven, but the trajectory is still moving in the right direction, which at the end of the day, that's the most important factor here. Stay with the process.
No, it makes sense. And you think of that process, I mean, Jack, I think investors fall into two basic categories, those that are in the accumulation phase and those that are already retired, taking income from their portfolios. And that's why at the Wealth Management Group, for those who are retired, we had stressed going into this year at this phase in the market cycle of having 3 to 5 years tucked away in various forms of cash flow reserve accounts. And for those who are in the accumulation phase, we just heard it from you. Again, volatility, while I think it's difficult to swallow in the short term, provides an opportunity for long-term investors to allocate to certain sectors at lower prices. Now, Jack, at the end of the day, you know, is there any historical precedent or formula that's actually good for the markets, right? You know, AKA, you know, is there an example where it's better to have a divided Congress? Is there a divine combination of maybe a Republican president and a Democratic Congress, or a Democratic president with a Republican Congress, vice versa? What, if anything, can history tell us? Because I spend most of my time, as does the Wealth Management Group, focusing on cash flow, PE, earnings per share. But what, if anything, given it's an election year, might I glean from combinations in D.C.?
Yeah, so we've gone back and actually looked at all of the different scenarios all the way back to 1928, and just from the average annual returns based on who's in control of both the White House and Congress, returns tend to be a little better when you have a Democratic president, and obviously the best return on an average perspective is a split Congress. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, the more overarching backdrop here, it's not necessarily who's in the White House or who's in control of Congress, although I think we've all been sort of taught the idea that gridlock is probably the best outcome. To me, what matters even more so, it's the economic backdrop, right? And if I sort of wanted to list through the biggest impacts, to me, one, it's going to be the earnings cycle. Earnings are what drive the market. Again, corporate America is very flexible. It's very good at coming up with ways to make money. And so whatever you present forward, corporate America will figure it out. And so thinking about the earnings per share cycle, where are we? Well, we're certainly coming off of some significant lows back in March. And again, as I mentioned earlier, we're moving in the right direction. So the economic recovery continues, albeit slow, but it's continuing. The earnings per share cycle is continuing to follow suit. That's what drives the market. That's what matters most. The second one, the prospects towards returning to our normalcy, if you will, the prospects towards moving towards a vaccine. We continue to make progress on that front. The question might be, when do we get to that? Maybe that's an issue for later next year, but we continue to make progress towards that. And then I would list third, the political backdrop, the shape of the backdrop for D.C. So a lot of this we certainly can focus on, but at the end of the day, the most important thing is still the fundamental backdrop, the earnings per share backdrop, the growth backdrop, and that is going in the right direction.
No, I think that makes all the sense in the world, and that's why we want to continue to focus at Wealth Management Group on controlling what we can control. I mean, it's undeniable math. I think at some point in time, additional stimulus, which is warranted and should be done, is likely going to mean at some point in time higher taxes down the road. I think inflation is eventually going to find its way. And the bottom line is, again, with printing money, you can't repeal and replace the basic laws of mathematics. You know, and hence we're concentrating more so than ever for all of our clients on the concepts of asset location. And remembering that the best hedge for inflation longer term is a portfolio of diversified equities in the long run. You know, we talked with all of our clients about the concept of TINA. You know, TINA being an acronym, you know, there is no alternative. And TINA could very well be back in play because, after all, we're at a point in time where the 10-year Treasury seems stubbornly compressed, 1% or below. Money market yields and CDs have collapsed. And I think the power of dividends is once again going to be front and center on the radar screen of investors once we move past this election. And on the election, you know, at the end of the day, it is what Jack mentioned. It is going to be valuations, cash flows, and ultimately earnings per share that drive things. But our leadership team here at the Wealth Management Group has spent time knowing that there are investment implications that could arise in various sectors, the most obvious, of course, being energy, tech, and healthcare. And we've done our SWOT analysis, strength, weakness, opportunities, and threats relative to just that. So the bottom line is, you know, we stand ready. And Susan articulated all of these potential changes that could come in play relative to income tax, whether it's tax changes for higher income earners. We're fully prepped and ready to go to implement and help you talk about the concept of income shifting. There could be a change in the capital gains tax rate. Susan mentioned that for wealthy investors. We're set to pivot and accelerate gains into the current lower cap gains environment for the right investors. There is the potential to have a big change in estate taxation, including a loss in the step-up in bases that Susan mentioned. And if we do that, I want to reassure everybody that we've already been in discussions with our tax and estate planning council and discussed four separate strategies that we can implement for the families we represent to help you maximize your legacy. And there is on the table a potential repeal of the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, and utilizing strategies to maximize the amount of money into the tax-free safety zone, that through which we call the Roth IRA, that's going to remain a staple in our arsenal, and we're determined and ready to push forward with that at the end of the year. So to everybody listening to this election call, I just remind you that the Wealth Management Group stands fast and ready to reinstill faith and confidence with everyone that's tired of the traditional model of financial advice, which is light advice. That's not who we are. It's not in our DNA. We're going to remain daily vigilant and bring to you and your families the ideas you deserve so that you not only can get retired, but stay retired. And if you know of anybody that's tired of that advice light, traditional model that financial advisors deliver, then we encourage you to have them reach out to us. We're here for you. We commit, as always, to put your family's interests first, and we'll be proactively reaching out to ensure that we capture whatever opportunities as arise via this election and what's forthcoming relative to the country. To Susan, to Jack, we appreciate so much our partnership. I'm thankful for your thought leadership as you keep the Wealth Management Group team involved, and I'm happy that you were able to spend some time on this call for the benefit of our clients to keep everybody informed and educated. Thank you both again for the extension of your time. Lisa, I'll let you bring the call to a close at this time.
Thank you, Craig. The opinions voiced on this call are for the general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. The economic forecasts set forth may not develop as predicted. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult with your financial advisor prior to investing. Securities are offered through LPL Financial, member FINRA, SIPC. Natixis is not affiliated with Wealth Management Group or LPL Financial. Thank you.